Welcome back, everyone, to the Movie Palace. As ever, I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and thank you for joining me again this week. On this episode, we're going to continue the film noir theme for November, and we're going to talk all about Out of the Past from 1947, a film starring Robert Mitchum, Jane Greer, and Kirk Douglas. And to discuss this film with me, I've got somebody with me who only went and named a blog after this film. It's my pleasure to speak again to Raquel Stetcher. Hi, Raquel.
Hi, Carl.
So how have you been since the last time we spoke? Because I know you've been to, like, Toronto, to the film festival there. I think you've been, like, rubbing shoulders with people like Robert Redford. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I've been having so much fun writing about new movies and having that experience going to a festival that is just premiering all these really amazing, great, big movies and independent cinema, foreign cinema. But I'm still trying to also work on the classic movie stuff, too. So I've been very busy.
So what's it like at a festival? I mean, I could just imagine that your time is very kind of, like, regimented. You got to be from one place to the next, and it's quite strict. Is that how it is or not?
Oh, yeah. So I basically create a very strict itinerary for myself with backup options just in case. And I stick to a very strict schedule. And I also, from my TCN Classic Film Festival experience, I know what I can handle. So I made sure I built in time for food and sleeping and writing. So I know how to handle it now, but yeah, you have to be on a very strict schedule in order to take in as much as you want to.
And yeah, it was really fun to, like, follow along with your Twitter coverage and your reviews and stuff. So great stuff.
Oh, thank you.
Now, what about film noir in general then, before we come on to Out of the Past specifically? Because on the podcast all month, really, we're looking at different aspects of the genre. So what does noir mean to you? Is it, do you class yourself as a big fan of film noir?
Yes, I have to say, because I fell in love with classic movies through film noir. Film noir really means so much to me. In fact, the very first classic movie purchase I ever made was a box set of 5 film noir movies. So they're just always enjoyable. I have never found a film noir that I didn't enjoy. They're just so sophisticated and stylish. I love how they explore crime without being too gritty or violent. I mean, today we have so many films that are focusing on violence and gore, and I like how this genre focuses on the situation and the characters. There's great dialogue. There's so much to enjoy.
There really is. I mean, what would you say are some of the best examples of film noir, aside from Out of the Past, which obviously I imagine you might pick, but other than that, what would be a few you'd kind of single out?
So DOA from 1949, or 1950, depending on who you talk to. It's a little, the details are a little sketchy there. That one is, like, probably my second favorite film noir. It stars Edmund O'Brien. It's just thrilling, and they've even remade it into, like, a contemporary thriller. But it's just such a great story. The Postman Always Rings Twice is really good. You have to go into my favorite director's filmography, Fritz Lang. He made so many great ones. Like, I love The Blue Gardenia. The Big Heat is one of my absolutely favorite films. And then Gloria Graham and Glenn Ford also made Human Desire, which is also a really great film noir. So they're both in that, and they're both directed by Fritz Lang. And The Woman in the Window, Laura. I could go on and on. There's so many.
There's loads, isn't there? There's a lot we could point to. But what do you think would be a good, like, starting point for people? Because we've just recorded an episode on Double Indemnity, myself and the guys from the 250 podcast. And we were sort of debating there whether it was a good one to start with, because I sort of felt like it's so good that it might kind of set you up for a fall with some of the stuff you'd get to later. But what would you start somebody off with if somebody came to you and said, show me a film noir?
Okay, so if it wasn't Out of the Past, it would be The Setup from 1949. It's directed by Robert Wise and stars another famous Robert Ryan. And the reason why I choose this as kind of like a gateway into film noir is that it's also a sports movie. So if somebody likes sports movies, or even if they like the Rocky series or any kind of movie about boxing, because that's what this one is about, that's a good way to kind of get them into film noir with a film that's kind of skirting two genres. And in it, Robert Ryan's like an aging boxer, and he doesn't know that he's being set up to lose a big fight with a much younger competitor. And when he wins the big fight, then all these problems appear. And it's just like a very taut, very well-told, dramatic story. And it's fairly short, so it doesn't take up too much of your time, but it's just thoroughly enjoyable.
It's interesting, isn't it, how we discuss film noir, and so many of them do kind of blend different genres together, don't they? Whether it's melodrama or whatever it might be, really.
No, it's true, and it's so interesting how film noir as its own genre happens so organically, and it required someone from the outside looking in to actually classify it, because it just appeared in American cinema so organically and naturally, out of just circumstances of what was going on in the world.
All right, so out of the past, I think you mentioned on the last time we spoke that this is a film with a very deep resonance for you, like personally, but this is a difficult one to kind of pigeonhole, I think, or to describe, because the plot's quite, I guess, convoluted at times. How would you describe this film, or how would you set it up for someone who hadn't seen it? Because hopefully everyone listening has seen the film, but it's possible there are some people who are kind of waiting to see if we recommend it before they check it out. So yeah, how would you kind of pitch it to them?
Okay, so, I mean, yeah, as you said, it's actually quite complicated. So it's hard to describe, but I would have to strip it down to its essentials and say this is a story about a man. He's a former private investigator who wants to lead a quiet life, but his past catches up to him. And this past includes like a double-crossing dame who he just falls hopelessly in love with, a dangerous gangster, and a batch of like duplicitous characters. Like everyone's double-crossing everybody. And then when he realizes he can't escape them, that's when the story takes a turn.
Yeah, and I like what you say there about stripping it to its essence, because I feel like even when the plot gets complicated here, it's like the character dynamics, there's still quite a clear through line there, I feel. So I think that's what kind of carries us through as an audience, isn't it?
No, it's true. It's true. I actually heard someone describe film noir as the characters are the sum of their actions. They're not wholly good or wholly bad. What they do in their the story arc describes what they are. And as you said, like, the characters very much stick to who they are. They're very true to who they are, but we see that through their actions.
Yeah, and that issue of somebody being wholly bad, there's actually a nice quote in the film, isn't there? I think it's when the character of Anne says to Jeff, like, about Jane Greer's character, you know, she can't be all bad. No one is. And Jeff's like, well, she comes close. What is it? She comes the closest.
Yeah, there's so many great lines. That's a good one.
Oh, yeah. You spoke last time about the massive effect this film had on you, but I mean, it wouldn't hurt to revisit that, I think. So if I remember rightly, it was like in a college film class or something, and you were shown this movie and it just kind of bowled you over. Is that what happened?
Yes. So I was, as an undergrad at Northeastern University here in Boston, I was an English major, but I took a film course as an elective. And what was great about it is that it really exposed me to films that I had just not tried before, including classic movies. And I remember there was what we would have at lunchtime. We would watch the movie, and then our class would start in the afternoon, and we'd talk about it. So I watched Out of the Past, and I was like, "Wow, what is this movie?" It was so sophisticated and polished. It went against any kind of preconceived notions that I had about classic movies being hokey or old fashioned or overly dramatic. It was just so amazing, beautifully shot. Great music, great actors, great characters. I was just so entranced. And then that last third of the movie is so confusing. And you're like, oh, well, I have to watch it again and again and again. And I don't remember the particulars of the discussion, but I think in the class, it was just our introduction to film noir. But for me, it was kind of an introduction just to classic movies. And I just fell in love.
So could you quantify it? Like, over the years, how many times do you reckon you've seen this film? Is it a lot?
I was thinking about it, and it must be over 30 times. I've seen it a lot, and I've seen it for different reasons. Like, one time I watched the film just to count the number of times they smoke, like how many cigarettes or how many punches or how many outfits Jane Greer wears, and or how many times like something is referenced. And other times I watch it just for fun because it's on, and other times I'll watch it just because I hadn't seen it in a while. I wanted to go back into that world and experience it.
I like that idea. I really do like the idea of looking for different things in the frame each time. That's great. I mean, I think I'd seen this film, I believe I'd seen it twice before this week. And I was trying to remember where I was, like where I was living and stuff the last time. I can't quite recall. So I think it may be as many as 10 years since the last time I've seen this film.
Okay.
So long enough that quite a few of the details had become a bit foggy in my mind. So there were some things that kind of surprised me this time. I think that I always really liked this film. I think I can see the film's greatness like even more clearly now. Like I watched it last night and then I watched it immediately again straight afterwards, to be honest. And this is an outstanding film in my opinion. I think the performances are just excellent. Mm-hmm. As you said, there are so many great lines. I'm sure we'll touch on some of them. I feel like the running time is perfectly judged. I don't think it's like a second too long. Any issues with the film I think are very minor and they don't really kind of detract from the whole, if that makes sense.
Right.
And back to what you were saying as like an introduction to film noir or as like an example of it. This does feel like an archetypal noir to me, you know, because one of the things I do before any podcast is I go to the library and I just see if there are any books on a particular film or what I can find, basically. And I was just sifting for a few books on film noir and I found a couple of just like general books on the genre that have like an image from this film on the cover, you know. And it's easy to understand why I think when you watch this film, why people would hold this up as like a great example of a film noir, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I would be very suspicious of a book about the film noir genre, and it did not mention Out of the Past. Like, it's considered one of the quintessential film noirs. I mean, even people like Eddie Muller of the Film Noir Foundation, this is in his top 10, and for just a reference to Turner Classic Movies, the late, great Robert Osborne, this was his favorite film noir, which I forgot about and relearned that recently, which endears me to him more. But yeah, no, it's got so many characteristics of film noir that it's just such a good go-to if you want to learn about the genre, which made sense in my film course in college that we went with that one.
Yeah, because there's lots of the elements that you'd associate with film noir, like straight off the bat, isn't there? So mm-hmm. It's stuff like, I mean, we could probably list a few here, but things like, you know, private eyes, flashbacks, voiceovers, you know, femme fatales, all these things. So pretty much everything associated with noir you can point to in here, can't you? I don't think there's any kind of key elements really missing, is there?
Yeah, I mean, also the lighting, the use of shadow, that's very important. And then, like, the dialogue. People, sometimes, like, when people are describing film noir, they don't necessarily bring up how great the dialogue is in those movies. And that's essential. Yeah. And it's so good in this one.
All right, so let's talk about some different aspects of the film. I mean, it starts off, of course, with this interesting opening with the character of Jeff, and he's running his little gas station and so on. And I think like the use of the, like the locations is very interesting in this film, because I think we think of like the city immediately, don't we, when we think of film noir? You know, because they're typically about like organized crime or like, you know, alienation in a big city environment. And the fact that this film begins in a small town seems quite noteworthy to me, and I like the way it kind of, the film becomes more of a noir the deeper you get into it, I think. You're sucked in the more that Jeff gets sucked back into his old life, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's a strength of the film that they can set it in the High Sierras in Bridgeport, California, and it still be a film noir. I mean, you do go into the city, you go into Mexico, you're to San Francisco, but a lot of it takes place in this very rural area. So the fact that they can set it there and it's not like just urban and gritty, it speaks to the strengths of the story and the characters. And I just want to do a little shout out to the fact that I'm actually drinking tea out of a Bridgeport, California mug. One of my friends, Laura, she goes to Bridgeport, California every year and she takes pictures of the town and it still looks like it does in 1947 and Out of the Past. It looks just like that today.
I tell you what surprised me then is that I remembered this opening slightly different, because what I'd forgotten is you almost get a sense that the community might reject Jeff a little. The way they talk about him in the diner and so on, and there's this element where he's interested in Anne, but there's this other guy, Jim, who kind of thinks of her as his girl too. And I just remembered that differently. I remembered him being really settled, you know, as the film kicks off, and it's actually slightly different, isn't it?
Yeah, no, he's definitely an outsider trying to make his mark. I mean, he has Jeff Bailey, like, printed very in large letters over his gas station. I mean, like, he's trying to make a claim on this town and as his new home for his new life. And, yeah, no, everyone's suspicious of him. And I think it's interesting how his girlfriend Anne, played by Virginia Houston, is just very trusting of him. And then you have Dickie Moore, the kid, who works for him, is also very trusting of him. But yeah, everyone else is very suspicious, including Anne's parents, who are like, oh, I knew about that about him.
Yeah, and they're like, are you going to let her go out like this when he comes to pick her up and stuff?
Oh, yes, yeah. There's a lot of really great, like, that's one of the things, too, you had said earlier about, like, how sometimes when you watch a movie again, things you're looking for. And one of the things I was looking for in this one is how Jeff Bailey / Jeff Markham is presented and what the clues are throughout the movie about his character. And in the beginning, you get lots of clues right away. You get to know about how the town is kind of suspicious of him and not very accepting of him. But then when you go into the flashback, when he's telling Anne the story of his past, and Wit, played by Kirk Douglas, and is hiring him to find Kathy Moffat, played by Jane Greer. And at the end of their kind of negotiation on price and what to do and everything, Robert Mitchum's Jeff stands up and says, what are you going to do to her? And then Wit says, I won't touch her. And I think that's very interesting. The thing I didn't notice about his character in previous viewings of this is that he actually cares what's going to happen to her before he even meets her. Like, he has the soft side. He's a good person. Even though he's being paid to find this woman who stole $40,000 and ran away to Mexico, he cares that he doesn't want to be involved in something where she gets hurt.
And I think Mitchum conveys that very well, you know. So yeah. I'd like to spend a bit of time on him. Now, I saw that you tweeted something this week about his voice turning you to goo or something, words to yes. that effect, I think. Was that because you were rewatching this film?
Oh, yeah. I actually forgot how nice his voice is in the voiceover throughout the film. It's very laid back and casual. I don't want to say it's soft, but there's something very kind of relaxed about it. That it kind of carries you very nicely and smoothly through the story. If he breaks into the voiceover, it doesn't take you out of the movie. You're just carried along for the ride. It's very nice. And I think it also just works very well for Robert Mitchum as an actor. I think if you had switched and given Robert Mitchum maybe Wit and given Kirk Douglas Jeff, it wouldn't have worked. I love both actors, but like, if you had Kirk Douglas doing the voiceover, I don't know if it would have been as effective, because his voice is like, he's got a lot more directed energy and this passion and this kind of fierceness in his performances, that it's the total opposite of Robert Mitchum, who's just so laid back, baby, I don't care kind of guy.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned his voice, and one of the things I did after our last podcast together was I went and got that book you mentioned, the Lee Server biography about Mitchum. And he talks a bit about how Mitchum's voice changed over the years. So, like, by the end of his career, he was really in demand for, like, voiceover work, because his voice just carried this, like, immense, like, authority. So it's kind of interesting how that changes over time as well.
Yeah, and the smoking probably didn't help either over the years, because he was a big smoker, and then eventually that's what did him in the end.
Yeah, and one of the things I've read here is that he may not have been first choice, but as it turned out, he's just an excellent fit for the part, isn't he?
Oh, because, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like you say, kind of, I guess his style's kind of low-key, isn't it, in many ways? And he really kind of imbues Jeff with this kind of world weariness and like a fatalism that's just so effective in the role.
Yeah, I mean, there's a subtlety to his performance, but, like, you know who he is as a character. Like, you know that he cares about Anne and that he's tormented by Kathy. And it just with small gestures and looks and the way he says things, even the way he enters a room or hides or how he positions his body, is all gives you clues about his character. And just Robert Mitchum does it so well.
And I think that, like, the off-screen antics of Mitchum are never far away when we talk about him, are they? And, like, he made, like, a strange arrival on set, or arrival on location, I guess, for this film, didn't he?
Oh, yes. In the Lee Server book, there's a story about how he and the producer, Warren Duff, I believe, flew in, like, this four-seater plane to Bridgeport, California. And when they landed, the pilot try to, you know, set the brakes, and the brakes weren't working. And then they basically crashed through a fence, hopped a ditch, and then, like, turned over or something. And then the producer and Robert Mitchum were knocked unconscious. No one was really hurt, though. So they were able to just kind of, you know, wake up, dust themselves off, and move on. But I think it's really interesting how the production of this movie started with a plane crash.
Well, thankfully things improved.
Yeah. But,
one of the things that book taught me, though, is about his, like, critical standing, Mitchum, at the time, where not all critics writing about movies in the 40s and 50s were kind of tuned into Mitchum, in the sense that, well, like we said, he's got this low-key style, and it seems like a lot of critics kind of disparage his acting ability a little bit. And I guess by the time I started watching Mitchum movies, his kind of legend was secure, you know, so it definitely changed over the years. But I just thought that was interesting, because I'd never really considered that, you know.
Yeah, I agree with you. It took years and decades for us to appreciate him. He was really not fully appreciated during his time. And also, they gave him a lot of roles that suited his personality and his character, like his talents as an actor. So it could very well be seen as Robert Mitchum playing himself in many, many movies, which, I mean, is fine, but maybe wasn't appreciated back then. And now it is. Now we look back and see, because he was just a lot more subtle about it. He was not about to, like, completely transform himself into a character. He was more about to give what he could in his talent set for this role.
And one story I particularly like is something Jane Greer said, where, like, he would turn up on set and he'd say, like, what are the lyrics? You know, kind of making out he didn't know his lines. And then, you know, when the cameras rolled, he knew him back and front, you know. So yeah. he had a very playful side to him as well.
He was always hiding the fact that he loved the work and that he was very serious about the work. Because he always said, oh, yeah, I don't watch my movies. Oh, I don't care. I mean, whatever. It's just work. I just show up and get paid. But really, behind the scenes, he was very serious about his roles and studying it, and even down to, like, the accents and getting just the particulars right. So he just had this bravado, but behind it, like, he was serious.
And he's got a great, like, female co-star here, of course, in Jane Greer. I think she's terrific in this role. I really do. And, I mean, one of the things I found out and I enjoyed reading about is kind of the director's instructions to her, so Jack Tourneur, who said, he's kind of like, you know, don't be expressive, you know, in the first half of the film you're good, in the second half of the film you're bad, don't overthink it, don't try and telegraph it, kind of thing. And I like that, because you can't really read a sense of her scheming into her early scenes, I don't think. And it works, I think, because it means, like, she's such an accomplished liar that you almost can't catch her changing gears, if that makes sense. Is that how you saw it anyway?
Yeah, no, I had watched that interview with her, and she said that Tourneur had told her en passive, just be impassive. And she does it so well. Like, you can't really read her face. Like, sometimes there's a couple moments where she smiles, and there's a couple moments where her eyes get a little big, but really she's holding a very passive face. And so you can't tell, you know, exactly. You can only tell by her actions later on in the movie, how she starts to double cross and then double cross and double cross again. But really, she's tricking everybody. And Jane Greer just did that so well. And I think she became known for that later on, is her ability to kind of hold a very, very passive face. And also, I mean, actresses back then had to do that as well. Like, Barbara Stanwyck was very good at just not being too emotive and expressive in the face, so she could play a character like she did in Double Indemnity.
And I think in this film, like, I think Jeff says to her on a couple occasions, like, oh, you're good, or, you know, words to that effect, you know. So it's like he remarks on how good a liar she is, which I thought was good. And I've seen reviews that kind of compared her character to, like, a reptile, you know. She kind of, like, lures him in. I thought that was an interesting comparison. But I think we completely understand, don't we, why, like, Jeff falls for her, like, hook, line, and sinker when he sees her in Acapulco, don't we? She makes such an impression.
Oh, yeah, she does. I mean, she's stunning. She has a presence. She has this kind of very soft femininity. But then she's kind of got this cold, very hard interior that we don't see until she does things. And we're like, whoa, what's wrong with this woman?
And just from what I've read of, like, her later career. It sounds like it was kind of impeded in kind of a sad way by like Howard Hughes had her under contract and didn't let her work as much as like she would have liked. And is that what you've heard too?
Yeah, that was terrible. I mean, he did the same with Jane Russell. And it's really sad because you think about, he also did the same thing with Gina Lola Brigida. Like he impeded the careers of several really great actresses who could have done more in their prime, but didn't because he held them back for his weird reasons.
And it's so sad because like such talent could have, you know, flowered in an even greater way than, you know, ultimately what it did. So yeah, terrible, I think. Yeah. And if we move on, I mean, one of the striking things, of course, is Kirk Douglas's appearance. And this is like a really early role for him, isn't it? It's like his third film appearance, I believe.
Right.
But like, I think his talent's already like evident, you know. And I mean, you talked a bit about the clash with Mitchum, and I understand this suggestion of like this kind of rivalry that goes on between them even after the film. But maybe it serves the story well. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's funny because I've read stories about how Robert Mitchum and Kirk Douglas kept trying to steal scenes from each other. And there's this one great scene where Kirk Douglas is like cigarette, and then Robert Mitchum's like smoking because he already had the cigarette lit in his hand. And I think that was improvised. So they were constantly playing off of each other, but they were completely different personalities, not only in the story, but in real life. They were just total polar opposites. So I can see them clashing, but the parts that they played suited them as actors so well that it's just great to see them on screen together. Yeah, they made another movie, it was called The Way West, years later, and they also played kind of total polar opposite characters. And I remember reading a little bit about from Kirk Douglas about his memories of Robert Mitchum, and he never said anything bad about him, but you could tell like they were just totally different.
One of the things I've heard here is that like a death scene for Kirk Douglas was shot, but it was felt to be more effective if we learn as an audience about his demise at the same time as Jeff does. And I mean, I'm torn. On the one hand, I'd like to see that scene, but I think it probably does work better the way it is, you know?
Yeah, I think, oh, that's interesting. I totally forgot about that. But yeah, you know, I actually would have liked to seen the death scene as well. But yeah, I mean, one of the things I like about film noir is that it doesn't focus on the violence. It focuses more on the situation and the story. So the method of him being killed or the scene of him being killed is not as important as the fact that he was killed and it was discovered later. So I can see that in terms of story. And also, I mean, it's a short film, so they probably had to take it out for time. Yeah, but I probably would have liked to see that.
Yeah, it's a shame it's not on, well, it's not on my DVD anyway. It would have been nice to see. Mm-hmm. So Jacques Tourneur, who directed this film, and he had a really wide-ranging filmography. I guess outside of this film, people maybe know his horror films best, you know, for RKO in the 40s, things like Cat People, I Walked with a Zombie. And I don't know, I think he was a good fit for this film because it feels like, from what I've heard, he had a very clear sense of what was needed at all points. Like, we've already mentioned the story with Jane Greer, you know, and his direction to her, which seemed like a very intelligent piece of advice to her. And one of the books I've looked at, and there was a good quote I found, which was that the book's by Eddie Robson, and he said this, that Tourneur's notion was that the actors should be like musical instruments, all tuned to the same key. As the film was based around Mitchum's character, the other cast members adopted his pace and tone. And you know what, reading that quote a little earlier, it just made me want to put the film on again, kind of like what you said, and just watch for that, you know, because I thought that was such a shrewd way to kind of sum it up, but I hadn't quite thought of it that way before. But yeah, the actors are like musical instruments, yeah.
That's super interesting because, yeah, I mean, this is really Jeff Bailey / Jeff Barkin's story, so it makes sense to kind of have it be his world and how he sees things, and then everything else is kind of in tune to what's going on with him because he's such a central character.
But the other thing is that, you know, he had all these ideas. He had this vision for the film, but he couldn't always realize it because of the production schedule and stuff like that. So, like, you mentioned about looking for Jane Greer's costumes, and the original intention apparently was that they'd become progressively darker as the film wears on, and then they'd be, you know, jet black by the end. But supposedly what happened is, you know, the schedule gets moved around. So that maybe happens to some extent, but it kind of falls by the wayside. So, I mean, I don't know. You might have noticed this more than me when you were looking for her costume changes, but does she start off in light tones and then it kind of
She does. Darkens? In that scene where Jeff Bailey is, or Jeff Markham, I always get that confused because he has two names.
Yeah.
Well, when Jeff is waiting in the bar in Mexico for her, and she comes in from the light into the dark bar, she's wearing, I mean, this is a black and white movie, but I'm assuming it's a cream or white colored dress. And at the end of the film, she's wearing almost like a, kind of like a skirt suit, but with almost like a nun's habit, like a weird long cap. And that's completely in black. So there is a little bit of that, but yeah, I mean, there's also that really great outfit she's wearing. It's like a sequin black dress. She's at the party, and that's when Jeff kind of sneaks in, and she's wearing like a fur shawl. And then he kind of like, she's about to call somebody to alert them that Jeff is there, and he knocks her down to the sofa, and the fur stole just kind of like dramatically comes off. It's funny because we learn this is a very like stylish woman who is used to the good life. The fur shawl kind of like dramatically being thrown off her, it kind of symbolizes her being thrown off her game. I love those little subtle things. And one thing about Jack Tourneur, which is interesting, he worked with Nicholas, I'm going to probably butcher the name, Musuraka, the cinematographer. And I love what they did with light and shadow and how the characters come in through doorways and how they're lit. And it's just so, so good. And just to call, they also worked on Cat People, which you had mentioned earlier. And that's another film that I watched that completely through my preconceived notions of classic movies out the door. I thought that was going to be a very cheesy horror movie with people in terrible cat costumes. But instead, I got a sophisticated thriller that was subtle and intriguing and did so much with... they had a very low budget, but they did so much suggestiveness with visuals, very subtle visuals. And they do that in Out of the Past too. I mean, they don't have a huge budget to work on this movie, but you wouldn't know it because it looks so sleek and sophisticated, and everything is done so well.
And in terms of what you're saying about like the look of the film, yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And a lot of that is, I think, because of the contrasts he sets up, you know, between like the small town scenes, like we said, and the city and Acapulco. It feels like the look of the film shifts around in a way that suits the narrative. There isn't like a uniform style that's being applied. Like a lot of intelligence and design went into it, it feels like.
Yeah, and with all those vastly different settings, you got Mexico, you got the High Sierras, you got San Francisco. I mean, those are all completely different settings, but you, there isn't just one cohesive style, but you don't feel like it's also vastly different either. It's handled very well.
Yeah, it's not done in such a way that it jars, is it?
Right.
It's quite an achievement, actually. Yeah, it is. And you mentioned like the budget and so on. And from what I understand, this was quite an elaborate production. You know, they had 64 days of filming apparently. And have you heard any more stories? I know we talked about the plane crash that kind of kicked things off in terms of Mitchum's involvement. But have you heard anything else about kind of issues they had on set and things like that?
Well, I remember reading that when they were in like the High Sierras and like, Bridgeport, California, there wasn't much to do. So people would just, you know, go to the one local bar and drink with Robert Mitchum and just tell stories and be completely like drunk by the end of the day. And I remember too, there was like, because the production took a bit longer than it usually does. I mean, movies back then were shot on a very, very strict, short window of time, that Robert Mitchum's publicist arranged, because he was like part Native American, arranged for him to be inducted into a local tribe as a publicity yeah. moment, because they needed to kind of keep the momentum going of the production of this movie. So that's a couple stories I heard. And also, like, they paid Robert Mitchum $10,000 to be in the movie, but they paid Kirk Douglas, who has a smaller role, $25,000, because they had to loan him out from another studio.
Okay.
So Robert Mitchum was already an RKO, like, part of their stable of stars, but, yeah, they got him on the cheap for this.
One of the things I'd heard is they were blighted a bit by bad weather when they were up in the mountains, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's like you say, they were bored, and that wasn't helped when they had to delay the shoot a couple of times and that sort of thing. Everyone seemed a bit stir crazy and that kind of thing. And I believe a bill was issued at one point. I don't know, Mitchum had done something. He'd begun on a drinking kind of spree, and I don't know if he damaged his room or something. I think I read. I can't quite remember.
I'm trying to stifle a laugh because I totally remember this story, and yeah, I think he completely destroyed a room. Yeah.
That's an interesting point, actually, because like one of the things reading the server book is there are all these stories about his erratic behavior over the years, and like some of them I knew already and a lot of them I didn't. So do we have a tendency to like glamorize people like Mitchum? Because one of the stories that kind of shocked me a bit, it was on one of his later movies, I think. He turns up for the premiere of his film and he throws a basketball at a female reporter and stuff like that. And I just thought, whoa, I mean, he's got this kind of Hellraiser reputation, but sometimes it seems like he kind of crossed the line. Is that how you see it?
Oh, yeah, he totally did. And I agree. We do glamorize that. That's, to me, one of the charms of him is that he just didn't care and he was just himself, even if that was at times, you know, destructive or invasive or, you know, hurtful to other people. I mean, he was terrible for an interview. In preparing for this, I rewatched Robert Osborne's interview with both Robert Mitchum and Jane Russell. This was shortly before he passed away, so it was like mid-1990s. And Robert Mitchum was just barking answers at Robert Osborne. And from what I heard from someone who was there and witnessed this, Robert Osborne was terrified of Mitchum because he gave him such a hard time. And some of his answers, like Jane Russell was there, I think, to help Mitchum with his answers. I mean, he was a tough personality. And I think the charm for me is that kind of reminds me of my dad, who was also like that. So maybe I'm more forgiving, but other people will probably think that Mitchum was just a jerk, you know, like he had some outbursts. So I get it.
Well, I wonder if it's like in a way, all that stuff, though, is quite a good fit for his kind of star image, isn't it? Like, it's not like he had a wholesome, squeaky clean image as a star, as a performer.
No, it's
so
true.
Maybe the other stuff doesn't hurt him in that sense, you know?
I mean, he got arrested for marijuana possession, and it did not hurt his career at all. In fact, I think it probably boosted it. But he also led a very hard life. I mean, his father died when he was very young. He, I think he was in a chain gang for a while. He grew up very poor, and he struggled to get to where he was. And I think he just stumbled into acting because he really liked work, and this was like good physical work that paid well. But yeah, he was also incredibly talented, and I don't know if maybe his growing up, he had to put on a tough guy demeanor, and he couldn't show maybe his more sensitive poetic side, and that maybe caused him to lash out. That's a possibility.
And it's like all these things that we mentioned too, like a hard life and heavy drinking and smoking, but so when he ages, he becomes this like living monument, doesn't he? And he kind of aged in a really interesting way, where he was kind of worn down, but he had this stature and presence and gravitas, I suppose. And I don't know, he's a fascinating star, isn't he? I know you said you singled him out as your favorite last time you were on the podcast, but he really is.
Yeah, his eyes were always very sad, but they got sadder as the years passed.
Mm. Do you have any issues with this film? Do you think it's a perfect film? I mean, what people normally point to, I think, is the plot. I just don't know how much it matters. I mean, it is overcomplicated, possibly. I think once the flashbacks end, it seems to get a little bit more confusing. But I just don't know how much it matters. Because, like I said, I think the character dynamics are clear enough.
Yeah, when I watched it recently, again, I the first like hour, I was like, why did I think this was so confusing? This is fine. But then you get to the last like third of it, and it becomes very, very complicated. But I think that was the charm for me the first time I saw it, is that it was so complicated that I want to revisit it and revisit it and revisit it, kind of make sense of it. So it could be seen as a flaw, but it seems also like a strength. It's funny, when I watch it again, there was a scene that always bothered me over the years, that it was Paul Valentine, Kirk Douglas, and Robert Mitchum sit down together for drinks, and Robert Mitchum like knocks over one of the glasses so that he can disguise the fact that Jane Greer just walked by. And I always thought they didn't pay for their drinks, and then I watched it again, And I saw there's a very subtle movement where Robert Mitchum takes the tab and a pencil and signs his name and then puts it aside. And I missed that. All the other previous viewings. And I'm like, okay, they did pay for the drink. But yeah, there's a lot of, there, if you, you have to watch it more than once because you can miss things.
I really like that scene you mentioned because you get a sense, don't you, of like the slight nervousness to Mitchum's character in that scene. I thought he played that scene marvelously. I didn't really think about the bar tab or whatever it was.
But, yeah. I don't know why. I was just like, why did they dine and dash? This is just so annoying. And it's funny. One thing I realized in this last viewing of Out of the Past is that there should have been more of Dickie Moore's the kid. I think he's such a crucial part of the story. I mean, at the very beginning, he has this great scene with Paul Valentine, who's Joe Witt's gangster kind of compadre. He flicks a cigarette at Dickie Moore to get his attention because he's dead. Like, the character's deaf and mute, so he can't. He doesn't know what's going on. But the thing is, because he's deaf and mute, he has to solely rely on his sight and to watch these people. He knows right away that this guy is up to no good, and Joe can't hide behind anything because Dickie Moore's the kid can see him for what he is by his actions and by how he presents himself. So he has that advantage over other characters. We know that Jeff learned sign language to be able to communicate with him. That shows another aspect of his kind of good side of his character. And then there's this great scene towards the end where the kid sees what's going on. Joe is chasing Jeff and is about to shoot him. And with just this very subtle kind of quiet moment, he just takes his fishing line, hooks it onto Joe, pulls him off the cliff, and he dies. And then just goes back to reeling the fishing line back, feeling almost like nothing happened. And he just saved Joe and continued the story with that one scene. And then just to point to one other scene at the end where Anne is asking the kid, was Jeff running off with Kathy? And he says, yes, just to save her future. And I was like, wow, this one character is so, so interesting. And I wish there was more of him. If it was maybe a 2-hour plus movie, maybe we could have gotten a little more of his story. But I think he's kind of the unsung hero of the movie.
Well, what I've read is that in the first draft of the script, he was a bit more pivotal in the sense that he was originally supposed to actually be the narrator of the film. And there were some structural differences. You know, I think there were supposed to be flashbacks strung out all through the narrative. And then, so the first draft was written by Jeffrey Holmes, or AKA, that's kind of a pen name for Daniel Mannering, who wrote the novel. And then, if I'm correct, I think James M. Cain took a crack at the script. And he made one really good change, apparently, which was that Greer's character, Kathy Moffat, was originally called Mumsy McGonagall in the first script.
Oh, that's terrible.
It is, isn't it? But Cain changed that, and that stuck. And he made some structural alterations that were retained as well. But then the final draft was by an RKO contract writer, Frank Fenton, who kind of combined the two versions into what we see ultimately. So yeah, I think the kid maybe lost out a bit in the sort of different iterations of the script, sadly.
Yeah, I think maybe if I were to pick a flaw of the movie, maybe that would be it. They could have had more of him.
So do you have any particular, like, because there are so many great lines, so many great moments, do you have any that you can sing about as favourites? I mean, one I really like, I'll tell you, is the look on Mitchum's face, I think, when Kathy shoots that guy who'd followed them, and he's kind of like, whoa. And I've always liked the way he played that reaction shot.
That's actually one I was going to mention. It's great because Jane Greer kind of backs up to the wall, but she's got, like, no expression at all. Mm. She's just watching them fight. And then when she shoots, and then, yeah, Robert Mitchum's head just whips to go see her and be like, what did you do? That's just such a fantastic moment in the movie. And just for me, too, all the scenes between Kirk Douglas and Robert Mitchum, just the playful kind of back and forth with the dialogue, I had new appreciation, especially that one scene I had mentioned before of, like, the cigarette. Oh, no, smoking. That's a great moment. But then also, there's a kind of a unintentionally hilarious scene further in the film where Robert Mitchum is going to get like the tax information that's in like a little briefcase, and he goes to like a nightclub and he enters the nightclub owner's office, and the guy's like, "What are you doing here?" And he just punches him, and then yeah. And then just like goes through the drawers and then lights a cigarette and leaves. it's so the Robert Mitchum's reaction to it is so fast that you're kind of like, whoa, what's going on? It's kind of funny.
We've talked a little bit about Anne, I think, but maybe not enough, because I think that I really like her character, Virginia Houston, and she definitely represents like an appealing kind of way out, doesn't she? Like, if he'd have chosen to stay with her, we'd have understood it, even though ultimately he finds kind of settling scores or, you know, or resolving the issue with Kathy more compelling. But no, I thought she had a really good presence too.
Yeah, I like how she's the complete opposite of Kathy. She's an outdoorsy girl. She's sweet. She has no ill intentions, whereas Kathy is kind of like the city girl who is very glam and, yeah, has a lot of ill intentions. So they play off each other. Even though they don't share scenes together, they play off each other very well. Well, actually, they don't. Do they share a scene? I'm trying to remember. I don't think so.
No, I don't think they do. No, not that I can recall.
And I have to say, when I watched this recently and I was thinking of the Anne-Kathy dynamic, I thought this film could be, maybe this is a stretch, but a metaphor for addiction. Like the Jeff Bailey of Bridgeport, California is like the sober Jeff. And he's trying to start a new life with Anne, and she's kind of his rock here. But this past is making him relapse into that addiction. And Kathy can be seen as kind of his drug, you know, from that past that he just is very tempted to go back into and eventually destroys him. So I thought that was kind of an interesting interpretation I didn't have on previous viewings.
Yeah, I like that. I hadn't thought of it in those terms. But yeah, like he tries to kind of quit her, doesn't he? He tries to go cold turkey, I guess. And he just can't. Yeah. That's a good one. That needs more exploration, I think. All right, so, I mean, what's your sense of how this went down on, like, original release in terms of whether it's critically or commercially? But, I mean, I get the sense this is one that kind of really gathered appreciation over time, and it took a little while, to be fair, didn't it, from what I understand?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it helped both Douglas and Mitchum's careers. I wish it had helped Greer's career more, but, from what I got a sense, it did well, but then it took until like the late 1970s for it to really be appreciated for what it was. And then when people were getting more serious about film noir and looking at film history, this one came up in conversation a lot and became really appreciated. But I don't feel like it wasn't a film that was swept under the rug and then rediscovered years later. I think it had appreciation at the time too.
Mm. A lot of what I did was I quickly scanned over some of the like the contemporaneous reviews of the film, and a couple of the things I saw that sort of came up again and again were a lot of the reviews seemed to really emphasize the confusingness, maybe overemphasize it really. So for example, here's a line I liked in the New York Times review from Bosley Crowther, which was, "The sum of deceitful complications that occur in Out of the Past must be reckoned by logarithmic tables, so numerous and involved they become." And I saw like three or four reviews along those lines, you know, where the critics just seemed kind of hung up on the plot elements to the expense of other aspects, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I could totally see that. And Crowther's reviews are just some very enjoyable to read because he was a tough critic.
Yeah. And a few reviewers seemed not particularly fussed on Mitchum. So James Agee said, "Bob Mitchum is so very sleepily self-confident with the women that when he slopes into clinches, you expect him to snore into their faces."
That's terrible. Oh, wow.
Well, it's interesting because then he would go on to, well, he gets the screenplay credit on Night of the Hunter, even though it's kind of disputed about how much work he actually did on the screenplay, AG. So interesting that he wasn't a fan at this stage, you know?
Yeah, Robert Mitchum was not the prototypical movie star of the 1940s. He really was not. I mean, somebody would have to be a little more, I mean, he had some charisma, but he wasn't like charismatic, like maybe a Cary Grant or something, you know? So yeah, I can see maybe like, who's this kind of laid back, casual, sleepy guy who's in this film? Like, I don't get it.
And also because he was working so steadily as well, even like all the way through his career, so that had this like immense list of credits. But of course, they're not all good. But what it means is that he probably made as many good movies as anybody when you total up the ones that did work, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, early in his career, he had some really bad parts. Like, he was in When Strangers Marry, and they tried to make him do a very dramatic role where he had this one kind of like over-the-top scene, and he does not do it well. It just doesn't suit him as an actor. He needed something more subtle, so like Out of the Past plays to his strengths, but something like that did not.
All right, Raquel, so what I thought we'd do is we'd go through some like listener comments I managed to get in on Twitter this week. And thanks to you, of course, you've been a staunch ally this week in trying to drum up a bit of feedback for me, so thank you. So starting with Afterglow, who said, "Cool was invented when Greer said, 'Did you miss me?' and Mitchum calmly said, 'No more than I would my eyes.' I love the film's bizarre structure and the different moods for each setting. The way it goes from a sunny proto-Twin Peaks town to flashbacks of Mexico, to a nightmare San Francisco." And, well, the comparison with Twin Peaks is really interesting, because I don't know if you've seen that series, but Jane Greer actually appears in Twin Peaks in the second season, just for a few episodes. So, and it took me years and years to kind of make the connection. Yeah, so have you seen that? It's kind of 1991, I think it would have been.
I've seen one episode of Twin Peaks, so I'm not as familiar. I saw the pilot, but I have not seen the show. But I kind of get what it is. It's like sleepy town, and something happens, and I get that aspect of it. But yeah, and also I think Jane Greer and Robert Mitchum appeared in an SNL skit making fun of Out of the Past, like in 1987. So that was like maybe a few years before Twin Peaks came on the air. So
yeah, I was trying to find that on YouTube this morning, but I couldn't find it unless it's hiding away on there, sadly. Have you seen it?
I have not. I've been searching for it for years. I don't know how to see it. I'd love to. I would pay to see it. Like if I think NBC has SNL, and like I would pay for just to see a clip of it.
If anyone listening knows how to get a hold of it, let us know. Please do. And, well, Afterglow actually put another comment on, which was, "My favourite scene in the film is when Jeff slips up and someone dies. All he says is, 'My timing was a little off.' It's the same beautiful, laconic dialogue we've seen throughout the film, but you can see from a glimmer in Mitchum's eye how broken he is about this."
Yeah, I completely agree. That's something also I noticed in when I was really taking a character study of Jeff when in this last viewing, is how he treats the whole situation with Eels, the guy who's trying to blackmail Wit because of the tax information he helped Wit not pay his income tax, and now Eels is trying to blackmail him for the money. And there's that great dialogue between Jeff and Eels where he's, you know, telling him like, "Oh yeah, I'm definitely not her cousin. And yeah, you're in trouble. I'll try to help you." And I'm like, he doesn't have to do that. But he also knows that Kathy and Mita are both trying to set him up for Eels' eventual murder. So he's trying to save this guy, but also trying to save himself. So when he finds out that he failed, yeah, you see that glimmer in his, like, you see that expression in his face where he's like, "Oh man, I failed in saving this guy."
Yeah, it's really well played, I think.
Yeah.
And Declan Gaffney got in touch with a comment about Jane Greer, who said that the part as written has zero interiority, and she plays it brilliantly with zero interiority. To convincingly play a dame who could get a bishop to kick a hole in a stained glass window is an acting challenge, whether or not you have that capacity. And I think I agree. I think that goes back to what we were saying about how, you know, how she'd been directed as well, that the different kind of facets of the character she embodies really well, I think.
Yeah, you really don't see that interior. Like, she does not give you anything of herself. Anything you learn about her character is all by her actions, but not by her expressions or anything she has to say. I just want to throw out, like, one scene that I really liked where Jeff is meeting her for the first time and they're sitting in that bar in Mexico, and then someone comes up to them trying to sell them like a tour and like some earrings and like all these other like knickknacks, and she can't be bothered. She does not react to anything, but Jeff takes pity on him and buys some earrings. She can't be bothered with the earrings, but he just feels bad for him. And that's a great scene where you show she has absolutely no like emotion at all in this scenario. And he's got this little, you know, he feels bad for this guy who's just hustling and trying to make a dime, you know. I thought that was super interesting.
Great stuff. And let me just run for a few more here. So Gabriella said, I absolutely adore Out of the Past, a tour de force of the genre. Robert Mitchum is fantastic as the slow-talking, world-weary ex-PI. Jane Greer is the ultimate double-crossing femme fatale, and the ending, absolute perfection. I agree, I really like that end scene. And now that you mention it, I do think the kid's role maybe could have, you know, might have served the film better if he was beefed up, but nevertheless, I think the ending works really well.
And that tweet, very well said. I pretty much agree with every point.
Yep. And Tony Brady said similarly, because he said, great film with fine acting from Robert Mitchum, Jane Greer, and Kirk Douglas. Robert Abides said, I had my doubts. At first, Out of the Past seemed to echo the plot of The Killers from 1946. A garage worker is actually a rogue hiding out from old friends in a backwater town. From there, however, the movie takes us on a dark journey full of twists and turns. And Mike Baker said, one of the very best, in fact, the epitome of film noir. Mitchum's doomed hero, Douglas's charismatically nasty boss, and Jane Greer, femme fataling over both of them. Who could want more? And I agree, I think that when this film ends, you know, as a viewer, I do feel fully kind of, I don't know, fully satisfied or something, like that the film's delivered everything it should have done, if that makes sense.
And I had never made the connection between this and The Killers. So when I saw that tweet, I was like, oh, now I kind of watch them as like a double bill and compare Ava Gardner's character to Jane Greer's.
It's been a while since I have seen The Killers, but it's been quite some time. So, yeah, that would be an interesting kind of comparison to make, I think. Mm-hmm. All right, so just two more. So Erica D said, I've seen this many times and really like it a lot. It's not my preferred Mitchum film or noir, but it's a Hallmark film. I mean, in terms of preferred Mitchum film, I think this is yours, isn't it? But what else would you kind of point people to if they're kind of interested? Maybe kind of like the highlights. What would be a few you'd kind of single out?
Well, you could just go see The Big Steal, which came out a couple years later, which reunites Robert Mitchum and Jane Greer. And they're basically, another character kind of steals money from both of them. So they kind of get together to go find this character. And it's completely different vibe, but it's kind of a fun movie. Yeah, no, it's hard for me because I just love pretty much everything Robert movie. But that's that. If you like Out of the Past and you like both Robert Mitchum and Jane Greer, it's not the best movie, but it's an enjoyable one. So that's like a nice one to follow up with.
I've just done a podcast on Night of the Hunter, which by the time this is released, will have been released as well. And I think what I said on there was that I imagine a lot of people find Mitchum these days through something like Night of the Hunter. And what maybe gets lost in translation almost is that film represented quite a big departure for him, you know, in terms of his acting. Whereas if that was the only time you'd ever seen him on screen, you'd just kind of assume he was always like that.
Oh, yeah. He plays such an evil character in that. And then he goes on to play another evil character in Cape Fear. This is like a whole other side that people hadn't seen from him before. But yeah, that film, I always forget that film is really a film noir, but then I remember how it's lit and how they do such great things with lighting and shadow in that movie, and it's just fantastic. It's haunting, and he's so good. Why didn't he get an Oscar nomination for that movie?
Well, especially because he busts out his singing voice as well, doesn't he? You know, so he did it all.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, last comment for now on Out of the Past. So Richard said, can't be beaten for poetic atmosphere. Jacques Tourneur, who worked with Val Lewton, Paul Valentine and Dickie Moore are just fantastic in supporting roles with little screen time. I've seen the film many times. In the beginning, had a lot of sympathy for Jeff. Now, no. So that was an interesting thought, I think. Like, it'd be interesting to kind of follow up with Richard. You know, why exactly has your view of Jeff changed over time? But that's an interesting take on it, I think.
Yeah, I've watched this so many times, I've never not had sympathy for Jeff. But I can see, like, his decisions later on kind of feel like, well, what is he doing here? Like, he's kind of put into a really bad position, so he's doing what he can kind of to save himself and kind of take down these bad guys. But I don't know. Yeah, I've never actually heard anybody say, oh, yeah, this, I do not feel for him towards the end.
Well, one of the things I think is interesting is that, like, a large part of his past is still a blank slate to us, even after we've seen the film, isn't it? Yeah. So It makes me wonder what other kind of skeletons he's got in his closet, you know, from before the events of the film.
Yeah. We don't know his life as a private investigator. We don't know other jobs he's worked on, how he became one. We have no origin story for him.
This is it. I think we missed out there, didn't we? We could have had some more Jeff Markham movies or something. But
It could have been a great series.
All right, Raquel, I think we'll leave it there for today. But do you just want to take a minute to kind of point people to things you're up to? Obviously the blog, but I know you've been doing various things like YouTube videos as well. So yeah, whatever you want to point people to, take it away.
Well, if you like old movies, I have a blog, Out of the Past, outofthepastblog.com. And it is, yes, named after this movie. You can also find my YouTube channel, youtube.com/outofthepastblog. I'm on Twitter at Raquel Stetcher, and I have a Instagram and new movie blog called Kel Movies, just kelmovies.com and at Kel Movies on Instagram. So if you go to my blog Out of the Past, pretty much all my links are on there, so that makes it easy. But I'm always posting about movies, whether they're old or new, and I love to hear from people who love movies.
Cool. And I know that last year you wrote a like kind of a behind or a making of piece on Out of the Past, didn't you? So I'll try and make sure to post a link to that when the podcast goes live too, because I mean we touched on some of the info today, I think, but there was also some other kind of nuggets in there that we didn't get to. So yeah, I'll try and remember to do that.
Thank you.
And listeners, I think next week will represent our last foray into the film noir genre for a little while, when we'll be looking at The Maltese Falcon. In terms of social media, all the usual places, so at Movie Palace Pod on Twitter predominantly, also on Facebook, facebook.com/Movie Palace Pod. But I hope you can join us next time, listeners, when the curtain rises once more at the Movie Palace.